Support for Here and Now comes from BetterHelp, committed to supporting mental health through therapy. Clients are matched with one of 25,000 therapists and can communicate via video, chat, or phone at betterhelp.com/public.
From NPR and WBUR, I'm Robin Young.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. It's Here and Now. Authorities in Turkey say they have identified the alleged gunman in the Reyna nightclub attack, but they are not releasing his name at this time. More than a dozen suspected ISIS militants believed to be linked to the attack were detained today, but the manhunt for the shooter continues. The BBC's Mark Lowen joins us from Istanbul. And Mark, we don't know this man's name, so what do we know about him?
Well, we know very little officially, Meghna, and that is a worrying thing for a country that wants to see this man apprehended, of course. All we know is that there's video footage of him that has been released showing that he was in Konya, which is a city in central Anatolia to the sort of southeast of Istanbul, sometime in December. He was there at a bus station in this footage. There are reports that he travelled from a suburb of Istanbul on the night of the attack, and that suburb has been raided, but there were no arrests made. That's pretty much it. I mean, there are various other media reports that he may have come from a Central Asian country or possibly been from a part of China, one of the Uyghur Muslim people within China. We don't know really officially much more than that, and at the moment the government is not revealing the identity of the suspect, who still remains at large, having killed 39 people in this New Year's Eve massacre.
Interesting. And the suspect has been on the run since early Sunday morning. I mean, there must be enormous pressure in Turkey to find this person. What can you tell us about the manhunt?
There is, because, of course, you know, 3.5 days after the attack, the fact that he's still not being caught suggests that the authorities are losing that crucial sort of window of opportunity just after the attack to try to stop him from potentially having left Turkey, crossed over a border, gone into Syria or Iraq. We just simply don't know. But unlike, for example, the Berlin attack before Christmas Day, when there was a photo that was released across the world, there were international police warrants and red alerts, and there was a reward offered for information leading to that suspect. Nothing of the kind has been offered here in Turkey. Now, we don't know whether this means that the Turkish authorities are simply keeping their cards close to their chest. This is a government that is difficult to communicate with and tends not to release things publicly, or whether they simply don't have the knowledge or the information about his whereabouts. But certainly when you speak to people on the streets, they are nervous that this man is still at large. Could there be a repeat attack, or could this lead to some kind of security fears in the future? And also, there are incidents now happening in which members of the public are seeing people who seem to resemble the suspect, and they are going up and trying to take some kind of mob or launch mob attacks on these people. There was a video that's just circulated on Twitter that showed people in a suburb of Istanbul seeing a man of Central Asian origin, it seems, thinking he was the attacker, running up to him. This one guy punches him and hits him, and he sort of beats him to the ground. And this chap was not the suspect. So, of course, that is the fear, that some kind of mob justice and mob attack and lynch mobs start breaking out if the actual suspect is not apprehended.
Well, even before this latest attack, you wrote a piece on the BBC's website that was headlined, "No Cause for Optimism in Divided Turkey." And I mean, this has been such an extraordinary 6 months, 7 months in Turkey, but yet no cause for optimism whatsoever. Why do you write that?
I don't think there is any light on the horizon, really. And I don't say that as somebody who is, you know, pessimistic generally about things or indeed about this country. This is a country that I have lived in for 2.5 years, reported from and love very much. But it is a profoundly shaken and unhappy country at the moment, for a number of reasons. First of all, of course, the terror attacks. There have been 23 major terror attacks in Turkey in the past 12 months that have caused 400 deaths. There is this twin terror threat from so-called Islamic State, which has claimed responsibility for the nightclub attack, but also Kurdish militants, the PKK, who have attacked several times here in the past year. And there was the attempted coup 6 months ago back in July, and there is a backdrop of deep political polarization that really has grown over the last year or so. Since the failed coup, tens of thousands of people have been arrested or dismissed. list. The government says that they are linked to the coup plotters, but many critics believe that that is not true, and that some of them who are being arrested are simply dissidents and critics of the government. So it is a very divided place. But equally, Meghna, when you speak to government supporters, they believe that they have a truly wonderful president and government who is caring for this country, and that Turkey has been abandoned by the West. So they would probably accuse me in this interview of taking one side. And that is the problem in this country, is that each side has its own narrative. But as a sort of hopefully an impartial observer, foreign observer, I can see a country that is, yes, some of the people in this country are happy, and of course they are absolutely behind this government. But the other half of the country is deeply, deeply upset and worried and negative about the year ahead.
Well, that's the BBC's Mark Lowen speaking to us from Istanbul. Mark, thank you so much.
Pleasure.
Well, here in the U.S., a storyline from the presidential campaign continues to blaze headlines as Megyn Kelly announced she's leaving Fox News to join NBC. Here's part of her video statement on her Facebook page.
Now, I don't actually know most of you, so perhaps it's not true love, but it's the kind of feeling that makes one feel connected to another human being. And that, after all, is why I believe we're here, human connection. The truth is, I need more of that in my life. In particular, when it comes to my children, who are 7, 5, and 3.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik has some thoughts. And David, a lot of people know Megyn Kelly as what the New York Times calls the countervailing presence at the opinion-heavy, right-wing-leaning Fox lineup, someone who took on Donald Trump famously in those exchanges and the debates, her own boss for sexual harassment, and Roger Ailes eventually left the network. So start there. What does this mean for Fox News that she's leaving?
I think it tears a hole in their primetime lineup. The Murdoch family, which controls Fox News as part of the greater Murdoch media empire, had been sort of intending to bet the future of Fox on her, in a sense softening some of Fox's more pugilistic and bombastic edges to somebody who's tough-minded but seemingly largely fair-minded, although perfectly capable of throwing red meat to the network's most faithful and conservative viewers. She'd really played it very cannily there, and she decided that she wanted a career beyond Fox News. But it's an interesting thing because as they were trying for the last year to construct a reality where they could take care of her ambitions to transcend the form of the hour-long sort of combat-driven nightly cable news discussion, the world changed around them. They expected not for there to be a Trump presidency, but for Hillary Clinton to be taking up office later this month in the White House, and that maybe things needed to be softened. Right now, this gives them the chance, if they want to, and I think they do, to double down, to become more of a channel sort of catering to its ideological core and to double down on sort of a kind of Trumpism. Rupert Murdoch was very skeptical of Donald Trump coming in. He's now been trying to make up for it and being very supportive, and you see that in what you see a lot of his hosts, Bill O'Reilly, particularly Sean Hannity, Tucker Carlson, and others, have to say on the air.
Yeah. Well, this image that I just laid out that Megyn Kelly now has in many minds, a lot of people are taking on that narrative, Media Matters. Headline reads, as the image that I just described as someone who valiantly took on bullies. But Media Matters headline reads, she has a long history of offensive, out-of-touch comments about minorities. In 2013, in particular, Megyn Kelly complained on air during a roundtable about an article in Slate that suggested maybe Santa could also be black. Here she is.
And when I saw this headline, I kind of laughed and I said, oh, this is so ridiculous. Yet another person claiming it's racist to have a white Santa. You know, and by the way, for all you kids watching at home, Santa just is white. But this person is just arguing that maybe we should also have a black Santa. But, Santa is what he is. And just so you know, we're just debating this because someone wrote about it, kids.
She also went on to say Jesus was a white guy, too, which historically and geographically he probably wasn't. Will those comments make it harder for her to transition to NBC? What does this mean for NBC?
I think that she's desperately hoping to get away from ideology, get away from inflammatory statements at NBC. I think she's looking to be more in the model of Diane Sawyer, Barbara Walters, Charlie Rose at CBS, somebody who can go for the soft focus interviews, human interest stories, as well as being able to do more serious news at times. I don't think she wants – I think she – you noticed in the announcement yesterday there was no mention made of MSNBC. She's not seeing herself as a cable animal anymore, and she wants to transcend that. And even though she made statements that were understandably seen as quite insensitive, others said that they were racist, I don't think they reflect who she sees herself as being or what you know, the great proportion of what she did was, even as there were other kinds of stories that I think she fastened on as a way of cementing her connection to Fox's audience. I think she played her career cannily, and some people say, I think with fair reason, that you know, that she deserves the criticism as a result of that. But she wants to leave that behind. From every signal she's given to her associates, to people who know her, she doesn't really want that ideological blanket. And I don't think the kinds of people who will be tuning in the daytime to NBC to watch her will necessarily have that at the forefront of their minds. I think they're going to be saying, you know, is she somebody who can connect? Is her sometimes cool heat in some ways, her intensity from Fox News going to translate to a more inviting and receptive presence for daytime television?
Well, it's interesting. In that Facebook clip, she said she wanted to leave to spend more time with her family, but she will be doing a daily daytime show for NBC as well as a news magazine on Sunday night to maybe go up against 60 Minutes. That's a lot of work there. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you so much for weighing in.
You bet.
Recently, we hosted an evening with the Bravo talk show host Andy Cohen at a sold-out Back Bay Event Center in Boston, a night sponsored by Harvard Books.
Please join me in welcoming Robin Young and Andy Cohen.
I received a very warm welcome, very nice. Then Andy came out.
Hey, everybody. Hey, everybody.
Simply put, Andy Cohen's fans adore Andy Cohen. One told me, he feels like he's my best friend. But she knows he's not. He's Sarah Jessica Parker's best friend. Here they are on Andy's talk show, Watch What Happens Live, with Andy's parents doing a pretend Sex and the City skit.
And action.
He's a bisexual.
Well, I could have told you that, sweetie. He took you ice skating, for God's sake.
I know. The weird thing was he was so open about it. He was like, you know, hi, I'm bisexual. Like, you know, like, hi, I'm from Colorado or something.
I don't think you're allowed to be bisexual in Colorado.
Andy Cohen is also Anderson Cooper's bestie. Both are openly gay and toured together to raise money for victims of the Orlando shooting.
Is there booze in this?
There is not.
Booze.
Yes.
Okay.
You can have booze if you want.
No,
on Andy's show and Watch What Happens Live, there's always,
yes,
they ply you with alcohol as soon as you go.
And Andy Cohen is just plain friends with everyone. His new book, Superficial, is his second diary of daily celebrity interactions, including with the casts of the various Real Housewives shows, those docu-soaps that follow groups of newly wealthy women in places like Orange County, California, and Atlanta, so that viewers can watch them spend money and turn on each other.
Give me the name of the guy I've slept with that's married.
You don't even know the name of the guys. How are we supposed to know?
The real hypocrite in this room is Bethany.
Who are you calling?
My boyfriend's daughter.
Oh, God.
You are born a liar and you are die a liar.
You're a horrible person.
Andy is the executive producer and host of the Housewives franchise. How did that happen? Press reviews include words like vulgar and desperate. One housewife, Teresa, went to jail for fraud. Andy studied journalism at Boston University and spent 10 years at the staid CBS News. How did that go from CBS News to Real Housewives? I mean, when did you, how did that?
Well, look where our country is now. I mean, it makes perfect sense. I always loved news, and I always loved entertainment. So I feel like I just kind of married the two, because the thing that is great about The Real Housewives is that it's real. We cast highly volatile, emotional, driven people, which is why it's real. But I used a lot of the skills that I learned at CBS News over those 10 years, recognizing great characters.
You know, there are people who think it's wonderful that you did the Real Housewives franchise. Yes. And there are people who think it's the end of civilization as we know it. And
but now that we've seen otherwise.
But some of them are in the news business. You talk about bumming into Brian Williams.
Right. I ran into him the night that Teresa was sentenced. And he was like, oh, your girl. Great job. You know. And I said, well, I have the exclusive interview tomorrow, Brian. So.
But do you ever feel a little uncomfortable? I mean, there's that time that there was this huge cat fight and you got thrown into the middle of it. It was suddenly the Jerry Springer show. You're on the floor. And it's people so often not at their best. And as you said, you cast them to get this kind of volatile thing. Do you ever feel a little badly?
Well, I think that, and I was asked recently, if I thought that the Housewives contributed to the discourse in the political arena today. And I think it's an interesting topic. I don't, you know, I think the reason that this show, one of the reasons the show works is it's sociology for me. It's sociology of the nouveau riche and the riche. And it's about human behavior. And we love judging other people's human behavior, I think. And I do think that it sometimes is about good versus evil. And hopefully good wins in the end. And hopefully, you know, you see me with them at the end of the season. And those reunion shows are meant to be like, you know, the final reckoning. And it is meant to be, you know, will Kelly Dodd take responsibility, honestly, or ownership? Will she take ownership for any of the things that she said? Now, if you last saw last week, it looks like she won't. But you know what? We move the needle next week. I'm not saying that she comes out of it like Mother Teresa, but I don't know. I think they're not meant to be role models. Some of them are role models, for real. Some of them are role models. And the show, if the show, do you watch The Housewives? You don't.
Well.
That's okay. No, that's okay, because
I work for public radio.
That's a lot of public radio people watch The Housewives.
So I'm
going to
say
promise.
It quietly.
Okay, that's fine.
Yes.
Oh, you do? Oh, okay, good. Okay. There's a moment in the book where I have a reporter from The New Yorker who is interviewing me about Bethany Frankel, and she says, can you explain The Housewives to me? Because people who read The New Yorker don't watch The Housewives. And I said, sweetie, no. No.
But help me with this, because I do often feel uncomfortable. I don't like to see people
in conflict.
No, not just in conflict, but put down or maybe right. Humiliated. I don't like that. Women too, set up against each other.
Well, I know, and they sometimes are. If it was only that, and that was the only note, I don't think 11 years later we would be talking about this show. I think it would be long gone. I think it's also about friendship. Motherhood, being a husband and wife. I think that some of the divorces that have happened on The Housewives have happened. They may have stayed in bad marriages forever and not had the strength or knowledge about the situation they were in if they weren't on this show looking at themselves and having other people say, look what you're in and look what you're doing. And somehow they have the strength of, wow, I have a voice now. I have a platform. And they take themselves out of it. There's a moment in the book where I debate Gloria Steinem about The Housewives. And I lose horribly. It's terrible. I'm the fool that on live television is like, yeah, we should debate this right now.
If the show was what you described,
yes.
I would feel differently.
You don't feel that it's that.
No.
You don't.
No. It is women all
hopped up.
Plastic surgeried
right.
And
okay.
Fighting with each other.
Okay.
It is a minstrel show for women.
Okay. All right, and I'm not going to win this argument whatsoever. Let me ask you this. Why have you watched more than... Why have you watched
it's like
it just
watching
sociologically?
It's like watching a train wreck.
It's like watching...
Well, Andy may have lost that debate, but he wins big time because Gloria Steinem is dissing one of his shows while on his show. Everyone goes on his show, and everyone is in his book, Superficial.
Is it as exhausting to be you as it is to read you?
Right. Sometimes. It depends. You know what? I consider myself lucky. I'm doing my dream job. I'm doing exactly what I always wanted to do.
Well, in a name drop competition, you would name
I would
drop,
win
mic
in a,
drop.
Oh, yeah.
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 So here's a little. Okay, got a text from Cher. She's worried about Ebola. Have felt so lonely since John Shea's wedding. Went to dinner with Matthew and SJP, Broderick and Sarah Jessica Parker, Anderson Cooper, Ralph Fiennes, at the Colbert finale with Patrick Stewart, David Gregory, Christiane Amanpour, and Jeff Tweedy. I mean... That's one paragraph.
I know. But look, this book is inspired by Andy Warhol's diaries. It's a window into pop culture during a certain period of time.
It's so openly a joyous diary of being a gay man.
Yes.
And we just don't see that. We don't read a lot about people and their best friends, Anderson Cooper, or, you know, really, really being attracted to the deck guy, I think, on a boat or something.
I love a yachty.
But have you always been that comfortable?
When I was in the closet for the first 2 years at BU, I was really scared. I was sure of myself in other ways. Yeah. You know, I'm the only gay guy on late night television, and I always say that my show is like me. It's gay is a part of the show, but it's not the show. Part of what I am is gay, but it's not all I am.
You also seem, I was curious how you describe yourself, because you seem, at the end of the book, to be a very different person.
I think so. It's interesting. I didn't consider myself a very introspective person, but I think I became one. Through the last book and this book, I kept a diary for 3 years. I mean, every day wrote in it. What started to happen is that I started to see what I did last year on that date, or I started to see a pattern of what I was doing, and I just started to think, am I going to do this forever? Is there something greater for me? And so I started asking myself those questions, and it was uncomfortable for me, but they're there, and I have to say, I became a little existentially exhausted by the end of the book. And by the last entry, I realized I am actually kind of emotionally exhausted from reporting on my own life. And I said, I just have to go live my life now.
Well, it sounds like you call it superficial. And it is bar hopping and restaurants, and you're at a bar, and if there's nobody there, it's like, I'm not real, I'm not happening. And maybe there's another thing besides freeing. Maybe it's maturity. You also say, hey, maybe there's something other than me that the world could be revolving around, including maybe a child.
Right, yeah. I mean, which is something that's been in the back of my mind, but it's something that becomes more to the front of my mind, yeah.
Well, I think you'd make a great dad.
Well, thank you very
Andy
much.
Cohen. Our visit with Bravo's Andy Cohen at the Harvard Books event for his new book, Superficial. So, okay, I've watched Housewives a couple of times. I'm trying to convince Andy to make it more of a 12-step spiritual program. Thermal imaging is often used in the defense industry for surveillance. French police used it in the search for suspects after the Charlie Hebdo massacre in 2015. But now the world's largest thermal imaging company, FLIR, is releasing more products for consumers, including some at this week's Consumer Electronics Show. Maggie Lake hosts CNN Money with Maggie Lake. She joins us from New York. Hi, Maggie.
Hi, Robin.
And one of the new thermal cameras released yesterday attaches right to a smartphone. What would a regular person, a civilian, use this for?
Another gadget we have to worry about, right? I'm not sure every single one of us is going to want to rush out and buy this, but I got a chance to talk to the CEO today, and they're really sort of pushing into two areas. One of them is for the outdoor enthusiasts, hikers, extreme sport fans, anyone who really is out in the wilderness and might want to use this for navigation, for search and rescue, importantly, or identifying wildlife. So that's one use. The other is really interesting, home repair. The company says that the FLIR one, the one you talked about that snaps onto your smartphone, can allow homeowners to identify leaks in pipes and places where heat is escaping your house, which at this time of year, especially in places like the Northeast and the North, is really important. It can save you some money. And of course, they also think this can be used year-round by contractors and inspectors. The price runs from about $199, which is pretty low, all the way up from $399 for the contractor version, and then all the way up to $1,300 for some of the more sophisticated versions.
And to give a sense of how this works, we all remember it horribly, the Boston bombing. But
yes.
A man found one of the bombers in a boat in his backyard by lifting the flap, and he saw him. But then helicopter footage confirmed there was a body under there with this thermal camera. You could see sort of the hot spots that show up because of the heat. And we know that FLIR has now teamed with the World Wildlife Fund to track endangered species and stop poachers. How will that work?
Yeah, and this is really important. And the two are connected in a way because the difference with this is that it works in total darkness and from a distance, right? So it kept the authorities up in Boston safe before they approached the boat. They let them know it was there. And in the same way with poaching, you know, the big problem with that, $20 billion a year criminal enterprise, it's hard to stop because of very large remote areas, a very limited number of rangers, and it takes place, most of it, during the cover of night. Now, this FLIR gear can cover that enormous territory long distance. distance detection and operate in total darkness. And in fact, the WWF says it's been like giving their Rangers a superpower that lets them see an enemy they previously couldn't. So everyone really hoping this can be a game changer in that, and that would be wonderful.
What about privacy concerns? A Supreme Court decision over a drug case, a federal agent using thermal imaging to see if someone was growing marijuana in his home. You have to use heat lamps. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court ruled thermal imaging violates civil liberties. Concerns?
Yeah, they are. But remember, that was back in 2001 when these were not out in the mass market. The Supreme Court said it violated an expectation of privacy. I think as these devices become more available and in the hands of more of us, the court's going to be challenged on that. They're going to keep trying. It's another example where technology is sort of running ahead of the law. 2001, that was, what, 16 years ago? We'll see if that changes this year.
That expectation of privacy, that is so
right.
2001.
Does any of us have it anymore? Exactly.
No, Maggie Lake, host CNN Money with Maggie Lake, talking about the new thermal imaging products that are coming for your personal use. Maggie, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
The nation feels as divided as ever. So can science bring folks together? Well, that's the thinking at a university in Pennsylvania where one professor has created a community project out of DNA ancestry kits. Students get a kit, they sample a bit of their saliva, mail the sample to the lab, and discover more about their ancestry and identity. Anita Foman is a professor of communication studies at Westchester University of Pennsylvania. She's also the founder of the DNA Discussion Project, and she joins us now via Skype. Professor Foman, welcome.
Thank you so much for having me.
So first of all, tell us the story of the genesis of the DNA Discussion Project. It started back in 2006. What gave you the idea?
Yes, it sort of started on a whim. I had always been interested in the Human Genome Project and had just been following it. And when I first started to read that they could use the mapping of the human genome to tell us something about our ancestry, I thought that was really neat. And at the same time, really serendipitously, our Multicultural Faculty Commission offered a grant for anybody who wanted to do something that was sort of unique to take a look at diversity. And I thought, suppose we ask people what they knew about their ancestry and then DNA tested them. And we looked at how the two stories came together or they did not. And that has really been the model of the project from 2006 until today. Ask people what they think, DNA test them, and then look at those two stories.
Now, the project has spread campus wide now since then.
And beyond.
And beyond. Did you think it would be such a community builder from the start?
I didn't know because I'd always sort of marched to a different drummer. The diversity training, et cetera, was going in a different direction. A lot of it was very confrontational. And so I knew that I was doing something that was different. The tests at the time were $450. So I asked for money to test three people. But immediately when I told people, I got three people, one who identified as Black, one who identified as white, and one who was biracial, Black, white. And since the beginning of that time, I have never had to use money to advertise because so many people wanted to do it and people have found it really engaging. So I've been a little caught off guard by how many people like it and how many people want to look at race in a positive way.
Yeah. So take us back to those first years that you did it, because it's been a solid decade now. What were the first reactions when the results came back? Did it get people to question preconceived notions they had about themselves?
Well, it was very funny because in the early days, because nobody had heard of this. This was, you know, a new thing. It was expensive. It was very rare. And so people thought that they were going to fit neatly into some category. The first woman who was white that I interviewed said, you know, I don't know what I would do if I found that I wasn't all European. So when we got back the results, and in the early days, the results are nothing like they are now. It was sort of this wild list of, you know, backgrounds that people might have. And even with those sort of vague results, there were things in there that she had not expected. And so it really did catch people off guard. And what happens is when somebody's surprised by what is in their background, there's this moment of opening that if you can sort of jump on that, it's very exciting to look at people's stereotypes, to look at their prejudices, and to say, gee, so many of the things that you thought aren't true, because if they were true, they'd be true of you. You know, if you have a little bit of African, or if you have a little bit of Middle Eastern, or in my own case, I had much more European in my own background, even though I'm African-American, than I would have thought.
Well, tell us more about that, because I was reading about the DNA discussion project in the Washington Post. You're getting a lot of attention now. And there were some students who identify as African-American. But as you said about your own ancestry, it's quite eye-opening to them to find out how much of a mix that they have in their own backgrounds. There was one student who was quoted who said, you know, it brought the complex and painful reality of what slavery meant in her family's background, you know, to the fore and made her think about it in a different way.
Oh, my goodness. And for me, the same. Now we've tested almost 2,000 people. So I've looked at a lot of African-American profiles, and it's as if slavery literally is written on our DNA. You see two primary zones. One will be the Gold Coast of West Africa, and then you'll see spots in Europe. And it just is chilling, because it's like that's what an African-American is. That is that combination. And it really brings to light what our history is. And it took me 10 years to test myself and found that I had a lot of background from Ghana, a background from Nigeria. I had the opportunity to go to Ghana to talk about this project. You go to a place that has the door of no return, where the African slaves went out into the slave boats. And I thought, literally, my ancestors probably walked through that door. And I also thought, literally, one of my ancestors probably raped somebody or their offspring who walked through that door, and that's why I look like I do. And both of those people were my ancestors. And you have to resolve that in a very personal way.
Hmm. Well, there's another student who I read about who, before he took the class and did the DNA testing, he thought of his ancestry, and this is a quote, as simply American. And then he got the results back, and he found out that he was only about one-third Western European, about a third British, 15% Eastern European, a little bit of hodgepodge of Italian, Greek, and European Jewish. And there was one percentage Middle Eastern. And he said he and his family found that surprising and shocking, and that he told his mother, and his mother didn't even want to hear about it.
Oh, we process these results a great deal in class, and we've had lots of discussion about things that show up in some of these backgrounds and attitudes that they have. Now, I teach at a state university, and so we have people from every background, from every political background, from every socioeconomic background, from every ethnic background, you know, all kinds of attitudes. And there are people who are not happy to find some of the things that they do in their background. And this particular gentleman and I talked about it, and he said, you know, I don't want to say that I'm prejudiced. This is just not something that we expected. And people from every background find things that they don't expect, and they have to get comfortable with that.
Have you had people who were so upset by the results that they've dropped out or have even refused to take the test at all?
I've had both of those things happen, and I don't want to put anybody on the spot or embarrass anybody. But I had one person that I was talking to, and I wanted the person to take the test. And I gave it to her, and she was carrying it around for a long time. And I said, you know, when are you going to take the test? And she said, you know what, I don't want to find out that I'm not this particular background. And I said, look at me, I'm African-American. I have all kinds of things in my background. And she said, yeah, but you know, you're all mixed up. I think I'm pure. And it really caught me off guard. And I've had other people who are from a similar background be very embarrassed that she made that statement. I have had, interestingly, a couple of African-Americans drop out of the project. In one particular case, there was a person who did not know for many years that she was biracial. And when she found out she was biracial, that was shocking to her. And then we ran the DNA test and found that her profile was almost all European. And that was very disorienting, and she dropped out of the project. And there are often things that we find people don't know, that they don't have the relatives that they thought, et cetera. So there are all kinds of reasons that people have brushed up against reality. Now, I will say we keep up with people in the project, particularly ones who, you know, find it difficult. And people are still glad that they took the test, but there have been more than a few times that people have found out things that they weren't planning on.
Can you talk about the unexpected power that this simple DNA test has now, especially because, you know, ostensibly America is still a multicultural society, but in so many ways it feels much more divided than it has in quite some time. I mean, it seems like this is such a simple but powerful way to begin to bridge that divide, because even in seeing that you have, you know, 1% unexpected ancestry might bring you closer to students who you felt you had nothing in common with before.
Yes, and I feel that that's our task, to sort of bridge that divide, because it's so exciting to see people go point and counterpoint, and it's, you know, it's energizing, and it's really easy to get pulled into a conversation where there are people on one side and people on the other. So our challenge is to be as interesting and provocative and engaging to create a bridge. And once you get into that middle area where we all share the same humanity, the conversations that are possible are amazing, and they're very unique, because we're starting out by saying we're all human, we're all made of DNA, much of what we think about ourselves is made up, and let's take a look at it without judgment. And that's been the place that this class has found itself in.
Well, Anita Foeman is a professor at Westchester University of Pennsylvania and the founder of the DNA Discussion Project. Professor Foeman, thank you so very much for speaking with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
A couple of stories we're following today. Authorities in New York City say more than 100 people received minor injuries when a Long Island Railroad train crashed into a station this morning in Brooklyn. Officials say that instead of braking, the train hit a bumper block at the end of the track and crashed through it. Metal that appeared to be from a rail also pierced the bottom of the train and the wheels lifted up. Officials at the scene estimate there were 600 to 700 people on the train. The accident is similar to the New Jersey Transit train crash in Hoboken in September that killed one person. Today, though, the train was moving much more slowly. The cause of the accident is still under investigation. And you may remember yesterday we told you about severe storms with heavy rain and flooding in parts of Alabama, Mississippi, Louisiana, Georgia, and Florida. A tornado killed four people in a rural Alabama town on Monday night. Unfortunately, now there's a new threat. A winter storm could blanket much of the South in the next couple days. There might be freezing rain and ice in Atlanta, and even parts of the Deep South, including Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama, could get some snow on Friday into the weekend. Well, the movie Moonlight has been hailed as a breakout film, a coming-of-age story about identity and sexuality. Two boys had starring roles in the film, and both are students at the Nordland Middle School in Miami Gardens, a school in Florida's Miami-Dade County well known for its theater program. But as the kids at Nordland tell Nadege Green from Here and Now contributor WLRN, while some of them may be on the big screen, the real star is their drama teacher.
Tanisha Seidel is leading her students at Norland Middle School in a full body warm up exercise. Seidel was in the same drama program when she was in middle school here. And for the past 16 years, she's been the one training young actors. She calls this her dream job.
I absolutely love what I do. It's a blessing to me to see them get it and to see them grow.
And she teaches us a lot, a lot.
Alex Hibbert is one of her students. He's in the seventh grade.
In this drama program, it made me disciplined. And I probably would be still a class clown, just not doing my work and stuff.
Last year, Miss Seidel encouraged him and nearly all of the other young men in her classes to audition for the movie Moonlight. Alex went to the Miami casting call and was hired for one of the lead roles. He plays the younger version of the lead character, Chiron. In the movie, young Chiron is shy. He's just starting to figure out his sexuality, and he's growing up in Miami's Liberty City neighborhood, where sometimes he gets bullied at school. In this scene, he returns home after spending the night at a drug dealer's house.
What happened? Huh? What happened, Chiron? Why you didn't come home like you're supposed to? Huh?
In Chiron's part, he doesn't talk a lot, but his face expresses how it feels, what he wants to say and stuff. And Miss Seidel taught me how to use my face to talk. She said that you don't have to talk, but your face could say it all.
Alex says his big break wasn't landing this huge role in Moonlight. His real big break was when Miss Seidel accepted him into the theater program 2 years ago.
Now I'm a grown man. Well, not a grown man, but I am an actor.
Forget your manners. You might refuse to stay.
The drama class is an old science lab at Norland Middle. A large empty space in front of the students' desks serves as the stage for rehearsal.
You don't follow directions, the director will do what? Fire you. This is part of the process. You must have the discipline, guys. You can have all the talent in the world, but if you don't have discipline, you will go nowhere.
Luck be a lady tonight.
The seventh grade drama class is rehearsing Luck Be a Lady from the musical Guys and Dolls.
And I know I sound like a broken record, but I'm going to say it until you get it. You cannot be on the stage and break character. You cannot do that.
We call her our drama mama.
Trinity Garrison is another of Miss Seidel's students. She says Miss Seidel has a way of integrating drama with other school subjects.
Let's say you learned about history in civics class. If you come to drama, you learn about it in a more fun way, not just the teacher telling you to write down notes, but you actually getting to sing and dance about it.
I think so many people think of the academics as, you know, reading math, and all of that kind of stuff. And that is true. However, there are some people on this earth who are built differently. You know what I mean? So they're more creative. And so we must cultivate wherever they are.
Alex Hibbert, the seventh grader who landed one of the lead roles in Moonlight, sees Miss Seidel as both stern and nurturing.
Her catchphrase? Boy. Like, I either did something or, like, boy, I'm proud of you.
The Norland drama students say Miss Seidel makes them believe they can make the honor roll, get into the college of their choice, or star in a critically acclaimed movie. For Here and Now, I'm Nadege Green in Miami.
Where would we be if it weren't for great teachers like
yes,
that?
Nowhere.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.